Major General Richards, Reel 8.
General, how would you say that Monty and Wave compared in terms of use of armoured warfare?
Well, unfortunately, you see, Wavell comparatively had very little armour put with him. All he had was the 7th Armoured Division and a battalion, which was the 7th Battalion, with the Matilda tanks. That's all he had. And so it's awfully difficult to say. The comparison is really... I don't think it's on, because, you see, Monty had not only 4 or 5 armoured divisions, the British armoured division, but he had all the American armour too. And so it's awfully difficult to compare the two. And Wavell was being pushed the whole time with lack of equipment, and Monty had plenty of equipment. No shortage.
Your job as such was to advise on how armour was to be used.
Yeah.
What were you kind of telling Wavell how it should be used, for example?
To tell the truth, I didn't. I didn't do that in that place, because, you see, it was so much simpler on the desert, because you had the divisional commander directly in touch with Wavell, which is the 7th Armoured Division, and there was the only other unit was the I-tanks under Jerram, and that was all decided in the forward area, how they should be employed, I think. See, Dick O'Connor, for instance, was commanding when they broke through and put all the Italians in the bag. Well, Dick O'Connor didn't want any advice, because of the simple reason that the situation changed daily. He had to make up his own mind. But it was... when it came to planning a battle, as you had to do in Northwest Europe and so on, shall I say, in Italy, you had to put on a bit of paper exactly how I think they ought to be employed. And then you might write a paper on how you think the tank could be improved mechanically, how the gunnery on the tank could be improved, and so on. And you'd write all these things on, having been around all these people and got their ideas about it, and so on, and you put on a bit of paper and put it in front of your commander-in-chief and see what he thinks of it. And if he thinks it's a good egg, he sends it off to the War Office. That's how it worked, really. Then, when I got to Northwest Europe, the other type of thing I had to do was members of Parliament would get up and ask stupid questions about German tanks and our tanks and things like that, and it was my job to answer them. You see, Monty would send the thing along to me and say, produce an answer for this, and then about a week later you'd hear your answer being given in Parliament. That's how that worked.
Was there some criticism then being levelled at comparison?
Always criticism being levelled. Always you get people saying something about the German Tiger tank or something was invulnerable and so on and so on, and what are we going to do about it and so on. Or our Sherman tank was no good or something like that. Or he'd heard that they'd lost 150 Shermans in one day. What have we got to say about that? And I'd have to write back and say, we didn't lose 150 Germans, we lost 15 or something like that. And said, take the naught off, you'll be about right. So on. It all went on like that the whole time. But what was really interesting with Monty was the fact that for instance, D-Day, we had a conference about 6 weeks before D-Day when all the commanders had to give their ideas of how they were going to carry out their roles. And I had to write out a sheet of paper for Monty to say how I thought tanks should be employed, which he obviously read. And when he got up to give his plan for the invasion and so on, he said exactly what I'd said on that bit of paper, and I don't suppose he'd read it through twice. He had the most magnificent photographic memory. And I've noticed it time and time again with him. I would write out something on a bit of paper, half a sheet or a sheet of paper, about the tank side of it all, and he would put it over word for word, practically. And I'm sure he did the same with the gunners, and he did the same with the sappers, too. And I'm sure, I'm quite sure he might have read it through twice, I don't know more. Wonderful gift.
What would you say, in terms of the kind of equipment advice you were giving, what was a major problem you were encountering?
The major problem was the gun. We were always undergunned. The Germans always had a better gun than us, the 88. And it was only at the very end of the war we caught up with them. That was a great snag. That was the gun side of it all. Because, you see, they always had the range of us. They could knock us out before we could even reach them, let alone hit them. That was the awful snag we were up against the whole time. The gun.
When you saw that happening, you would write reports about it.
Oh, yes, you write reports about it, but we got rather tired of writing reports about it. Everybody knew the form. A lot of people wouldn't believe it, either.
Did you encounter, then, resistance to this thing you were telling them?
But lack of natural firepower? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. From the War Office, they thought the two-pounder was just first-class, you see. I presume they preached this two-pounder was first-class because they hadn't got anything else. And they were waiting for something else to come along, which was a six-pounder, which was much better.
Didn't they come out to sea? Didn't anybody sort of
came out to sea, yeah. I had to give a demonstration to show the difference, which we did. Got a German tank and get a two-pounder and we'd fire at the German tank and the two-pounder shell would just bounce off.
Bounce right off?
Well, yeah, just fall down, yeah. Which they couldn't believe. The Germans had some type of hardened, case-hardened armor, which was, I should say, at that time was the best bit of armor they could get hold of. And our anti-tank guns had no effect on it at all, which is rather demoralizing for the crews.
Who came out at that period? Do you remember anybody who...
Yes, Martel, one of them. Richardson came out, and Martel came out. I remember those two.
Was Martel responsive to this problem, or did he?
Well, I don't know whether I think he probably was, but he was making out the two-pounder as a perfectly good shot. I think he's doing it from a political point of view because he got nothing else. I don't know, maybe he was trying to boost up our morale.
What about mechanical breakdowns? Were you involved in problems over that?
Oh, great problems, yes. The snag was, you see, in the 42 and 43, they put that fellow Inchcape, was it? No, that Canadian fellow, what's his name, Lord Beaverbrook. Winston put him in charge of tanks, equipment and so on, to get some tanks. Well, you see, he produced lots of airplanes, he produced lots of tanks, but he produced no spare parts. The result was a tank would break down, and you're done, you left the tank. Perfectly good tank left because there wasn't a sparking plug or something to fit it. And that was because of Beaverbrook. He was told to produce tanks, and he produced tanks. He didn't produce any spare parts. You see, and that's how these politicians get their kudos. And that was an awful drawback with us, because these tanks which we had, quite a number of them and so on, were badly put together. They wouldn't last. I mean, the engines would pack up in no time, and you'd take the thing to bits, and you'd find probably a screwdriver or something like that in the sump, being left there by the fitters, things like that. It's all very well happening in England, but it's happening miles away in the desert somewhere. You can't do much about it.
When you went to Italy, was the situation a lot improved?
Oh, the situation improved, yes. We then had Sherman tanks, and our tank business was better, but even so, we were still up against the gun.
When you went to England, you were advisor Home Forces, Lord Armour Corps.
Not harmful, Home Forces. I was advisor 21 Army Group.
Well, what did that involve?
Well, that was when I was with Monty for Northwest Europe, you see. You had a half by branch. Well, you see, Monty, when we invaded Europe, half his army consisted of Americans. And we had a lot of American armor, and half my staff were Americans, and the other half were British. The head of American, on the American side, was a Colonel Wright, who I still correspond with and so on. He became a Major General, retired into California. And that was our job for invasion of Europe. When we had, I had to go around all the armored divisions to inspect them and so on, see that they were, see what the troubles were, and so on. And we had a lot of armored divisions, American and British. The trouble was they're all organized differently. So we had a lot of difference for the supply business. And advise them as much as we could on that line. I had a long conference with Eisenhower and Bradley on the subject. And I went and watched Patton with his two armored divisions practicing on the plane and so on. Which is very interesting, really.
What did you reckon on Patton?
Well, Patton, you see, was one of these people who was a complete fire eater. And he's a very brave man. And was always in the front line and just wasted tanks right, left and center. I mean, really had no mercy on tanks at all. And soon after we got to France, well, when we were in Belgium, actually, so on, he'd used practically all his tanks up, and all the American tanks up, and I had to send him from our tanks in Belgium, I had to send him nearly 200 tanks to keep him going, because he just merely wasted them right, left, and center. Well, you know, you can be a jolly good commander and get jolly good results if you've got a bottomless source of equipment. That was his trouble.
Do you think that he appreciated armored warfare in the way that, say, Monty did?
Oh, I think so. Oh, yes, I think so. He's a very difficult fellow. I mean, he's just as difficult for the Americans as for us to work with. Because he reckoned that there was nobody else on the battlefield except himself. He must have everything, you see. It's very difficult.
What about Eisenhower? How did you get on with him?
Oh, excellently. Excellently. He listened to what you said, all right.
The idea was that you were trying to get these two countries, the armed forces of both countries, organizing one unit.
As much as possible, yeah. Makes such a difference from the supply point of view.
Did you manage to do that?
Not completely. Fairly well. See, we had Polish armored division, we had a Czech armored brigade, and we had a Canadian armored division, and so on. They're all different.
When you were working with Monty, how did you sort of get on with him? What sort of man was he to work with?
Oh, very easy. Just didn't trouble you. The trouble was, I mean, it wasn't the trouble. I mean, he allowed you to make one mistake, but you were not allowed to make a second mistake. And he's quite right. He said, I am dealing in men's lives, and all I can afford is one mistake. Can't allow anybody to make a second. He's quite right.
So people were very much on their toes with him, were they?
Oh, they had to be, yeah. I served with him for 2.5 years and so on. And you had to know your answers, all right. And so, like that, provided he left you alone entirely to carry on with your job, and occasionally he would call you up to tell you something, or you want a bit of advice on something. Otherwise, it didn't worry you. Discuss personnel, whatever, things like that.
How did that compare then with, say, Wavell?
Oh, as I say, it's awfully difficult to compare the two, because it was so different, you see. Different. I mean, we only had one armored division and just a regiment there. So, and all I was trying to do was to equip the cavalry divisions. The cavalry division, all the regiments of the cavalry division. I dealt mostly with a fellow called Smith, Arthur Smith, who was his chief of staff. I was only there for about 6 months, I think, or even less, before I went to G1 of the 7th Armored Division.
I believe you were involved in the withdrawal from the 1st Alamein.
Yes.
Battle.
I was commander of the 4th Armored Brigade, and my brigade took the brunt of the attack on the first day and so on, and we knocked out nearly 100 enemy tanks, but unfortunately I lost a regiment in the battle, and from that day onwards the whole operation seemed to be turned into a kind of battle of chaos, nothing else. The trouble was that on the battlefield, whether it was a dust storm or not, I don't know, but you could not see more than 100 yards because of the sand clouds and so on. And we never seemed to be able to get the armor concentrated to carry out an attack. And it was always used in penny packets. The result was we lost a lot of tanks. Undoubtedly, armor was very badly handled, I think, very badly handled. But if a person who would tell you more about it than me would be Willoughby Norrie, because he's a corps commander there, and he'd be able to tell you about that battle much better than I would, because he saw it on a much bigger scale. I say I commanded the 4th Armored Brigade, the 23rd Armored Brigade for the Battle of Alamein. I had four regiments of tanks and some gunners. And my job was a support of infantry, close support of infantry in the attack. And we finished up in Tunisia with the surrender of the Germans. 1,500 miles further on, I think. I had Valentine tanks at the time, and my Valentine tank, which I used the whole time and so on, I ran onto a minefield once and broke a track, but otherwise the tank went the whole way to Tunis with me. Must have covered well over 2,000 miles, which is pretty good effort for a small tank like that.
What were you carrying fuel-wise then? I mean, how was the fuel organized?
The what?
The fuel.
Oh, you got your transport behind, two RSC companies behind you, keeping you stocked with fuel and ammunition and rations the whole time. Well, one of the fellows who was with one of the companies lives just down here. You see a fellow called Burge, I see him quite often.
Did you you rounded up some Italian units yourself, did you?
No, when we got to Tunisia, I mean, the whole blinking lot of them were in an enormous concentration bag. They were all kind of cornered. They couldn't get away with it. Germans and Italians and everybody mixed up.
That's fine. Thank you, General.
Thank you.